This time on Weather Brains, crumbling levees and the chance a major hurricane might strike. Sound familiar?
People need to be made aware of the risk they're in because the majority do not know it.
We look at one part of the U.S. coastline some say could be a disaster in the making. Also, has your thermometer ever gone berserk? Well, here's a story you may find hard to believe.
The temperature was 4 below 0 at 7:32, but at 7:34, just 2 minutes later, it was 45 above zero.
More about where and when it happened coming up. Plus, you've heard of heat lightning before. Well, guess what?
There really is no such thing.
Brian Peters explains about that, and on Weather Brains 101, the distinguished Professor Peters helps us learn about thunder, too. Plus, we'll tell you how you can see a tornado's damage path from a satellite.
Cool.
And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks at what was a very surprising weather event for folks in Alaska, and the amazing sight a man living in Greensburg, Kansas saw when he looked up during this week back in 1928. And what's this? One of the Weather Brains crew is getting a special honor?
I think actually he's getting an award, I hear.
It's all coming up. It's episode 73 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. Hello, I'm David Black. With me for this ride is J.B. Elliott, Bill Murray, and Brian Peters, a.k.a. the Three Weather Musketeers. Brian Peters, what do you know about yourself?
I don't know a whole lot about myself. I just know a whole lot about the weather.
You're just a professor kind of guy discovering meteorology every day, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Discovered a lot of meteorology over the weekend with a local big event in Birmingham, a world-class downtown city streets festival called City Stages.
Well, we have folks listening in other parts of the country, so they may be interested to find out about some of the festivities that go on in the southeastern U.S. And with us as well this time, Mr. Bill Murray, who I don't believe is on the road in some parts out west, north, or wherever. Where are you, Bill Murray?
Actually, I'm at home tonight. I'm forecasting, doing radio and doing our web-based products because James is on vacation.
Yes, Mr. Span has taken the week off, and I guess it's probably a well-deserved week, you think?
Definitely.
I think, actually, he's getting an award, I hear. So
really?
Part of his trip is vacation, and part of it is getting an award.
So. James, somehow he kind of missed telling us about that.
Yeah, Mr. Modest Span didn't say anything about this, but I think he's getting some big award in Washington, D.C.
We'll grill him about it when he returns. J.B.
From NOAA, I believe.
Oh, how are you, J.B.?
I'm okay. I don't know anything about anything.
You're a smart man. Don't try to pull that on us. And we do want to say best wishes to Kevin Selle, once again not with us, but he's on the road to recovery and doing a lot better, and I'm sort of optimistic he might be able to join us next time on Weather Brains. We hope so anyway, but he is definitely on the mend, and that's good news. We're glad to hear it.
I saw his email, and Kevin, we're pulling for you, sir.
Absolutely.
Yes, and you know, don't want him to get too much better because he's gotten 4.5 inches shorter.
Yeah. Hey, Kevin, my apologies to listeners, but here's a closed circuit message to Kevin. Kevin, the other Weather Brains guys are sick of that guy, David Black. Got to get him out.
Kevin was 8 feet tall, so he needs to shorten himself.
Yeah. He's a tall, striking dude, I'm told. But we never have seen any pictures of him on the Weather Brains website. We've got to give him grief about that, too, when he gets back.
Mm. Yes.
All right. Well, yeah, just the hat. Hey, speaking of grief, the weather is bringing a lot of grief to people in the Central Plains, a really feel for folks in the central U.S. Torrential rainfall has caused flooding across parts of North Texas, a lot of warnings across the state of Oklahoma as well. 2 people killed in Texas, dozens of people forced to flee their homes, inundating much of the city of Gainesville. So some parts of the country getting more water than they could ever want or wish for, and yet other parts of the country high and dry. The drought continues. So, Bill Murray or Brian or JB, let me put you on the weather spot. Just give me a little national forecast for the next few days. Who's going to get storms and rain? Who's going to stay dry? Anybody?
Well, the southeast is supposed to get some rain with a weak cold front moving through the southeast, and of course the southeast and especially north and central Alabama has been the focus of an exceptional drought condition. So we're really pulling for some rain here. If Kevin were on, I think we'd all be asking him why he's not sharing a little of that rain they've had out there in Texas.
I think they would share some if they were able to, no doubt about that.
Did you guys see that live water rescue televised by KDFW today? Yes. In Sherman, Texas.
Yeah. Lots of people getting flooded out. And, you know, we talk about the dangers of different types of severe weather a lot, and justifiably so, lightning, tornadoes. But flooding's a huge personal threat to your life, too. Brian, you taught a lot about that when you worked with the National Weather Service, warning the public about the dangers of flooding. People Surely. Get washed away and drown all the time, don't they?
They sure do. And, you know, you wouldn't think that cars would be one of the major sources of fatalities and flash floodings, but it is. I haven't checked the absolute latest statistics. When I retired from the Weather Service 3 years ago, 75% of all flash flood fatalities were related to automobiles. I guess somehow or other we feel like if we're encased in 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of steel, we basically are invincible, but that's not true. Water is a very powerful force.
Yeah, I hope that people in the plains don't have to deal with too much more of it. Once again, it sure would be nice to see some other areas of the country getting some badly needed rain. Speaking of rain, we look for activity in the tropics, of course, to bring needed rainfall to parts of the Gulf Coast or Southeast U.S., and I get the impression, guys, that the tropics are rather quiet at the moment.
Yes, there was some kind of a little tropical wave over the Southwest Caribbean, but it was away from any convection and didn't amount to anything. And I don't know of anything that's going on further out in the Atlantic. I haven't noticed anything.
Yeah, I think there's still a pretty substantial layer of dust out there right now in the eastern Atlantic, too, David, when I look today. And I also heard that our anticipated La Nina may be becoming more of a neutral event, not an El Nino or not a La Nina. So that may make the forecast step down just a little bit as we head into the season, hopefully.
May have to be some revised hurricane forecasts, do you think, possibly?
Let's hope so. The temperatures and the sea surface temperatures are still quite warm and about a degree above normal over a good bit of the Atlantic, but not quite as warm as they were in 2005, so that's a good sign.
Okay. Well, speaking of hurricanes, this brings us to one of the main topics of our show this time. We saw what Hurricane Katrina did to New Orleans with its system of vulnerable levees, and with what's predicted, at this point anyway, to be a busy Atlantic hurricane season now officially underway, concerns are turning to what might happen to other parts of the American coastline. Well, one of those spots is the Rio Grande River Valley of South Texas. It's one of the country's fastest growing regions, and it has some uncomfortable similarities to New Orleans. The valley has its own series of levees. I did not know this. 270 miles worth. They're designed to prevent flooding. They were put in place following Hurricane Beulah, which struck in 1967 and which caused massive flooding. Now, like New Orleans, concerns are growing because those levees in South Texas are old and starting to erode. We've heard that before. One man who spent a lot of time inspecting these levees is Joseph Tucker. He's a retired engineer with the International Boundary and Water Commission. I'd never heard of them, but they are a federal agency, although a small one, operating under the State Department. Mr. Tucker says if a major hurricane strikes the South Texas Valley, the situation will not be good.
We're very vulnerable to a flood. That's the aspect that I'm knowledgeable on. I worked for the Boundary Commission for 31 years, retired as project manager. I saw two major floods, 1958 and 1967.
67 was Beulah, right?
Right, that was Hurricane Beulah. And, of course, it depends on the route that the hurricane takes. Like we had Hurricane Allen in 1980 and no flood. But Hurricane Beulah went up into the mountains around the Monterey area in Mexico on the Rio San Juan watershed. And we got an unprecedented large flood, larger than any we had records of. The floodway system was not designed to handle that size flood, and we had extensive flooding. And since after that flood, a lot of money was spent. I don't recall the exact amount, but 30-some-odd million dollars to improve it to handle an even larger flood. But since that time, the 40 years since then, we've had no major floods. So a lot of the river has silted up, brush has encroached into it, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife has put in their brush corridor between the levee and the river. All of these things have decreased the carrying capacity of the river. And if we had a repeat of Beulah now, the river levee would be topped in several places. We'd have too much water in the floodways. And we'd probably have millions of dollars of flood damage here in the valley.
What could this do to people?
It could hurt the heck out of them. that could be lots of property losses. I wouldn't anticipate much loss of life like they had in New Orleans because we're in a different situation. We're not sitting in a hole like they were. But we would have very extensive property damage.
Now, South Texas, I understand, has over 250 miles worth of levees. Are these similar to the levees in New Orleans?
270 miles. I'm not familiar with the New Orleans levees, so I wouldn't comment on that.
You helped maintain the Texas levees?
Yes.
What kind of shape are they in?
They're not in adequate shape to handle another Beulah-sized flood.
Why have they not been maintained properly?
They have been maintained fairly well, but they are probably degraded, and, you know, every time a car goes over it, well, dust flies, and you lose a little. And I'm not sure how much has been lost in different places. I know a lot of gates have been put up to reduce traffic, but that plus the fact that the river will not carry the water it did before because of the three factors I mentioned, all of this adds up to a bad situation.
What did you try to do in your capacity to try to fix this? What could you do?
Well, I retired in 85. Things were a lot different then.
I understand that there have been some efforts within government to try and get funding to upgrade the levees. Has that made any headway?
Very little. The Boundary Commission, I keep close touch with them. I've been retired since 85, but I keep in close contact. They have money for just a few miles, and they're working to initiate that, working on plans to raise a section of levee from Hidalgo upstream to junction with the Banker floodway, which is, I don't know, just a few miles. And it's a drop in the bucket, but it's all they've got money for now. As I understand it, well over $100 million is needed to bring the project up to where it would protect against the Beulah-sized flood.
Wow.
And that money hasn't been forthcoming. I know our congressmen and senators have asked for it, but they haven't succeeded.
What worries you about this?
Well, I hate to see people damaged like they were in 67. I know some people were hurt mighty bad, and there's a lot more people here now than there were then.
If you see a major hurricane form and get into the western Gulf of Mexico, what are you going to be thinking?
Well, I'm going to be thinking, I hope it isn't a Beulah repeat.
What's the biggest problem with the levees? They're designed to help prevent flooding, such as what would be caused by a hurricane, but you're indicating they are not up to the task any longer.
No, because they contain the water like in the river levee. We've got levees, Mexico's got levees. Call it the river floodway. And like I said, because of no major floods since 67, the river channel capacity has decreased. You know, siltation in it, brush has encroached into it, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Corridor has come about. All of those three things decrease the carrying capacity of it. When you decrease the carrying capacity, you raise the elevations, and now it would top the levees.
You were there when Beulah hit and had all the flooding. What are your memories of that?
They're very vivid. I can remember it. I can remember the flow figures. I'm 80 now, and I've forgotten a lot of things. My memory's not too good on a lot of things, but on that, it's sharp and clear. Beulah itself, the storm wasn't as bad as the flood to me. The flood came a few days after the storm.
How bad was it?
It was bad. The flood was. Here in Harlingen, there was a lot of houses flooded. I remember seeing one house that with the roof was completely submerged on 25th Street. And the cleanup after it was a nightmare. Some people had a foot of silt in their yards and no telling how much inside the house. It was a huge cleanup mess.
You're afraid something like this or worse could happen again if preparations aren't done adequately.
Right, that we're vulnerable.
You haven't had a major flood there since 67. Are you concerned that this is causing some complacency?
Probably, yes. The majority of the people here in the valley have probably never seen a big flood. And very few of them understand the project, how it works, and the situation it's in.
What are you hoping at this point, Mr. Tucker, that Congress will face up to this?
Yes, that would be great. And we need publicity on it. People need to be made aware of the risk they're in, and because the majority do not know it.
That's Joseph Tucker, a retired engineer with the International Boundary and Water Commission, speaking to us from his home in Harlingen, Texas. The vulnerable valley has been the subject of scrutiny by lawmakers and emergency planners as well. You heard him make that comment. Speaking at a hurricane conference in Galveston in April, Texas emergency management official Michael Harmon described the South Texas Valley, quote, as our potential New Orleans. Meanwhile, Congressman Ruben Hinojosa, who represents that district, is reported to have tried repeatedly, without success, to get federal money to shore up the levees. Now, according to a study the Boundary and Water Commission conducted in 2003, if a flood similar to that of Hurricane Beulah's were to happen there now, the U.S. levees would be overtopped along 38 miles along the Rio Grande River, with water breaching the levees for about a mile. We asked for interviews with Carlos Marin, current head of the Boundary and Water Commission, as well as Congressman Hinojosa and Texas State emergency management officials for this report. None of them returned our calls. Guys, kind of sounds to me like yet another case of we're warning you, we may be saying we told you so. Any thoughts?
Yes. That's scary.
And the same thing happened, I remember, with Katrina in New Orleans. FEMA, do you guys remember the disaster model scenarios they ran way before the hurricane ever struck that showed the potential impact? And, you know, we're hearing the same kind of thing again for South Texas now. And I'm just wondering if anybody's going to be listening and facing up to needing to come up with $100 million to fix this problem. And that's one part of the coastline.
Right away it's needed. I believe Beulah was also the hurricane that triggered so many spinoff tornadoes. Of course, most of them were F0s, F1s, F2s, but they can really trigger a bunch of tornadoes.
Well, you'd like to think that post-Katrina, there is a much more heightened awareness about the after effects, you know, not just the wind of the initial impact, but, you know, the flooding that's gonna come afterward and stick around for so long. And I just wonder if people are really facing up to that in Texas. Mr. Tucker doesn't think they are.
That's a good question.
All right. On to the weather roundtable. What's on everybody's mind? JB, you were talking to me one time about thermometers going crazy or something. What was that about?
Hey, you know, David, I've always been interested in major temperature changes and wild changes in the weather. And one time, for example, back in the probably 30s or 40s, there was a 100-degree plunge in temperature in 24 hours at Browning, Montana, from 56 above zero to 54 below overnight. And I was on duty at the Weather Service one day, and I was watching satellite photographs come off the machine every 15 or 30 minutes, and I saw 14 inches of snow melt away in northeast Colorado due to a Chinook wind going down the east slope of the Rockies and fanning out across the plains. But that's not what I wanted to talk about tonight. What I want to talk about tonight is in Black Hills, South Dakota, on January 22, 1943, and this particular event was caused by a very shallow Arctic air mass along the north and east slopes of the Black Hills with warmer air above. The boundary between the warm and cold air shifted back and forth somewhat like a rock in a bowl of water, resulting in unbelievable quick changes. In Spearfish, the temperature was 4 below zero at 7:32, but at 7:34, just 2 minutes later, it was 45 above zero, which is a jump of 49 degrees in 2 minutes. And at 9 a.m. it was 54, but at 9:27 it was 4 below zero, a drop of 58 degrees in 27 minutes. Strange things happened. Thick frost formed on almost all of the automobile windshields as people drove from the warm air into the cold air. Glass window panes were broken. Plate glass windows were broken all over town in the storefronts because of the huge change in temperature. And it went from, you could go from bitter cold on one side of a building to balmy weather on the south side of the same building. The temperature change was so extreme.
That's amazing. Is that a record? Has something like that ever happened before? Do you know?
That's a world record on that change in 2 minutes.
Goodness gracious. You wouldn't know what to dress for going outside.
You sure would not. No, not with that. That's an unusual situation, of course, and the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls wrote a special weather statement on it just a few years ago, remembering that. So that was a spectacular situation.
Well, I always thought it was a fairly big deal if you had freezing temperatures for a low in the morning, and then you got up into the 80s or something in the afternoon, that kind of puts a whole different cast on temperature extremes.
Right.
Thermometers going berserk.
Yes.
Speaking of berserk, Brian Peters, what's on your mind?
Well, JB talked about temperatures, and this is the season of heat, but there is a myth in weather, and that is heat lightning. You know, we did the Weather Brains 101 about lightning last week, and heat lightning is something that really doesn't exist, but what happens is people see it typically in the summertime, and they'll see a thunderstorm, especially at twilight or as it gets into the evening hours, the nighttime, and they see a thunderstorm, but it's so far away that the thunder never gets to them.
But you just see the flash.
But you just see the flashing, and you never hear the thunder, so... It was given a name years and years ago, I guess primarily because it's a phenomenon that you don't usually see at other times of the year. It's seen primarily in the hotter season, so it was given the name heat lightning. But it really, there really is no such thing. There really is a thunderstorm going on wherever you see those flashes, even though at in the humid air of the summertime, those thunderstorms may be 75 to 90 miles away. But thunder only travels about 15 miles for the sound.
Well, you just answered a question I had. I've often wondered how far away the storms were occurring if you were seeing very distant flashes off on the horizon. So 100 miles is reasonable.
It is. I remember one situation when I was working in Memphis. The Weather Service was on the fourth floor of a four-story building, and we were watching some flashes off to the south, and we just looked over at radar, and the thunderstorm was 85 miles away.
Goodness. Okay. Pretty impressive displays of Mother Nature for you to be able to see something that far away. There's a little bit of electricity in those charges, isn't there?
Just a little bit, yeah. Yes.
Well, okay. For folks in the northern U.S., of course, it's tornado season right now. I thought this was pretty interesting. June 7th had residents in central and northeast Wisconsin under several warnings when a series of tornadoes raked that state. One of the tornadoes left a track that's clearly visible on images of the area taken by NASA's Terra satellite. If you'd like to take a look, we've got a link to the picture that satellite shot. It's posted on our website, weatherbrains.com. You guys have seen some cases, too, of tornadoes striking other parts of the country, the southern U.S., where the tracks would actually show up on satellites, right?
Yeah, I've got a print. I've got a black and white print of the super tornado that moved through northwest Alabama and Guyon in the 1974 outbreak, and it's clearly visible. The path is clearly visible through the Bankhead National Forest.
Is it just a function of the width of the path being wide enough to show up on the satellite as well as the length? Is that why we see them like that?
Well, it shows up better on the satellite if it goes through a heavily forested area, and that's what was the case there because
right.
Much of Winston County is national forest.
And I think that's what happened on this latest case in Wisconsin that's on the satellite image. But it's fascinating to look at. And again, that's on our website, weatherbrains.com.
I think, too, David, that the satellite technology is getting even better. As we get, you know, better resolution, we're able to see those really small features like tracks.
It's fascinating to look at. Really gives you an appreciation for the power of nature when you can see something like that from, how many miles away is it, Brian? 22,000 miles?
Yeah, 22.5, I think, something like that.
Yeah, not 100 or a couple of hundred miles up, but a pretty good distance out there. So check out that picture. It is pretty interesting. Email bag for Weather Brains this week. We heard from Kayobi Tierney from Seattle, Washington. Thanks for contacting us. Also heard from Jeffrey Fuller and got email as well from Les Rayburn in Birmingham, Alabama. We appreciate it. Weather Center time on Weather Brains. First off, get those books and pencils out. Yep, it's class time again with Professor Peters and Weather Brains 101. This time, our distinguished educator teaches us about thunder. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks at a surprise weather event for folks in Barrow, Alaska. It happened this week back in 2000. This is a grim anniversary for residents of Fargo, North Dakota. And what a man living in Greensburg, Kansas, looked up to see during this week back in 1928. It's all coming at you.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
Last week, I talked about lightning, a pretty complex subject. Lightning is an atmospheric discharge of electricity, but lightning never occurs without its partner, thunder. The cause of thunder has been the subject of centuries of speculation and scientific inquiry. The first recorded theory is attributed to the Greek philosopher Aristotle in the 3rd century BC. Early speculation was that thunder was caused by the collision of clouds. Numerous other theories were proposed, but by the mid-19th century, the accepted theory was that lightning produced a vacuum along its path, and that thunder was caused by the subsequent motion of air rushing to fill that vacuum. Later in the 19th century, it was believed that thunder was caused by an explosion of steam when water along the lightning channel was heated. Yet another theory explained that gaseous materials were created by lightning and then exploded. In the 20th century, a consensus evolved that thunder must begin with a shock wave in the air due to the sudden thermal expansion of the plasma in the lightning channel. In a fraction of a second, the air is heated to a temperature approaching 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Yes, that's right, 50,000. This heating causes it to expand outward, plowing into the surrounding cooler air at a speed faster than sound would travel in that cooler air. The outward-moving pulse that results is a shock wave, similar in principle to the shock wave formed by an explosion. You can estimate how far away a bolt of lightning occurred by timing the interval between seeing the flash and hearing the thunder. Sound travels much slower than light, approximately 1,100 feet per second. The speed of light is so fast that it can be assumed to be infinite for this calculation. Therefore, if you see a lightning bolt and the thunder arrives 5 seconds later, that bolt occurred approximately 1 mile away. This calculation can be just a bit tricky to do when there is lots of lightning occurring with a storm. But do note that thunder is seldom heard at distances over 15 miles. And if you have a fear of thunder, you have astrophobia. That's WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's look back at some interesting weather history for the week of June 19th through the 25th. New Jersey recorded its worst tornado back on June 19th, 1835, when 5 people were killed by a storm at New Brunswick. Now, a tornado in the same location today would be horribly destructive due to the population density there now as compared to 1835. The tornado was the first to be widely studied by meteorologists. Now, 49 people died on June 19, 1938, when the Olympian passenger train crashed off of a flood-weakened bridge in Montana. On June 19, 1972, Hurricane Agnes made landfall on the Florida Panhandle coast. The weak Category 1 storm caused little problems in Florida, but the low would re-intensify along the east coast, causing destructive floods from Virginia to New York. 134 people died. In 2000, on June 19th, residents of Barrow, Alaska were surprised by a thunderstorm that moved over their city about 11 o'clock in the evening. Now, the event is noteworthy only because it is the 6th thunderstorm that they've ever experienced in the Arctic coastal city, and it's the only thunderstorm in history ever to move directly over the town. Now, Wednesday will be the 50th anniversary of an F5 tornado that devastated the northern part of Fargo, North Dakota, killing 12 people. But the storm had a silver lining. Researcher Ted Fujita authored a groundbreaking paper on the structure and life cycle of the supercell thunderstorm that produced the tornado, and we still use the terms that he coined in that paper today, words like wall cloud and tail cloud. Back on June 22, 1928, Mr. Will Keller of Greensburg, Kansas, had the unique opportunity to look up into the middle of a tornado funnel as it passed directly over his storm cellar. He said the air was still and there was constant lightning inside the funnel, with numerous small tornadoes rotating around the inside of the larger funnel. Back on June 22, 2003, the largest hailstone ever in U.S. history fell near Aurora, Nebraska. The giant stone measured 18¾ inches in circumference and 7 inches in diameter. And it was back on June 24, 1957 that, on the basis of meteorological data and a radio report from a shrimp boat, that the Weather Bureau in New Orleans issued the first advisory on a tropical depression in the Gulf of Mexico. The depression was located 300 miles south of Brownsville, Texas. It would go on to become Hurricane Audrey. moving northward over the next 3 days and striking near the Louisiana-Texas border, causing extreme loss of life. That's This Week in Weather History.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Murray. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks here at Weather Brains, we have two ways you can do it. Email us, question@weatherbrains.com. If you'd like to leave a toll-free voicemail, you may do that. 1-888-247-8627 is the number to call. Again, 1-888-247-8627 is Weather Brains voicemail, and it is absolutely free for you to call. For the Weather Brains crew, J.B. Elliott, Brian Peters, Bill Murray, I'm David Black, thanking you for joining us and hoping that you can join us again next time for the next episode of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2007. All rights reserved. Adios. Enjoyed it, gentlemen. Thank you all very much. Had fun.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Right. We need to figure out what this thing is with Span. What's he up to in Washington? Getting an award? We're going to have to really grill him on this.
The Mark Trail Award.
The what? Mark Trail?
Yeah, the Mark Trail Award for promoting NOAA Weather Radio.
Really?
Yes.
Are they going to give him like a Span bobbleheaded doll or something, or what does he get?
No, I think he gets a plaque of some sort.
Well, that's pretty special. So why wouldn't that Rat Fink tell us?
Well, he basically is a Rat Fink. No, he's basically shy. He never toots his own horn about things like that.
Well, we're proud of the boy nonetheless. Doesn't have any hair, but we're still proud of you.
I think it's great, you know, that he's being recognized for all of the work that he does in promoting and trying to keep people safe.
I would like to think that his efforts and yours and J.B. Elliott's, for that matter, and Bill Murray's too, have maybe saved some lives. You reckon?
I reckon they have. The problem is you never really know.
You never will know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those facts that goes with the territory of the weather business. You never really get that direct feedback to know. I mean, somebody doesn't know you issued a tornado warning that they heard that saved their life, and so, you know, you never can connect.
Anybody ever mention that to you, JB, when you were working at the Weather Service doing updates on weather radio?
Yes, the day of the Smithfield tornado, a lady said that the weather radio saved her life. She was in the path of the tornado. And that's the one and only day, I believe, that we went live on weather radio. Did not bother to tape the warnings or tape the updates, but just went live because we saved a little bit of time.
And who knows how many other people that you'll never know, you'll never hear from, have their lives today because of information they got off radio or television. Interesting.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Very well, gentlemen. Thank you, guys. Have a good time.
Have a good week.
Enjoyed it.
Bye.
Good night.